This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Michael Pavlich.
We're joined this morning by John Hewson, who's the Professor of Law at the Crawford School of Public Policy and, of course, at ANU. Of course, you know him as the former Liberal opposition leader. Very good morning, John.
Good morning, Pav. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Now, basically, John's joining us to talk about federation because he believes federation's outdated. Perhaps the system's even broken. There's a lot of duplication in the system and a lot of national issues are being frustrated because state and federal governments can't work together. I've got a text here for you, John.
Yes.
From Ian that says, how much GST should be paid on a cake? Thought you might enjoy that one.
They don't let that die, do they?
No, people won't let go, will they? Now, this, you've written an extensive article on this and a number of articles. This is something that you feel very strongly about. It seems quite incredible, this day and age, that there still is this lack of cooperation between state agencies and state and federal agencies. One of the really struck me was a few years back, I was the emergency services broadcast coordinator here at the ABC, and I had in that role had a charge over a few different states, had to keep eyes on bushfires in a few different states. I could not believe that there is not a national unified way of dealing with these things. So in every state, the fire agencies are called different things. They have different ways for labelling their fires. They have a whole different process for going through things. It just seemed incredible, such an important thing. I mean, there's fighting fires and saving lives, and yet still there can't be a national cooperation. There can't be a unified front on that level. That's just one area. If we go through it, there are stacks of them. That really is a bit of a bee in your bonnet, as I said, and something that maybe we really need to look at. Federation perhaps is broken and outdated, John.
Yes, look, it is. The point you make is very real. I mean, almost every day you see examples of significant differences between states that impact a lot on the daily lives of people and constrained businesses and so on. I think one of the points you made is, of course, a lot of duplication. We have a federal Department of Education, we have a state Department of Education, we have a federal department of, and so you have these layers of government which are quite unnecessary. I mean, most states and hospitals, schools and hospitals, for example, are state-owned and controlled. So you don't really need a federal Department of Education. I mean, Canada's a good example where they have provincial government responsibility for education, and there is no federal minister, there is no federal education department. And so you can reduce the cost of government, the number of people involved, the size of bureaucracy, the number of politicians by just dealing with that. But, of course, it's become very difficult over the years to get that division of responsibilities accepted.
Yep.
And so then the downside of that is, of course, it ends up with a complicated process, and it's compounded by the fact that in a lot of areas, particularly in business-related areas, the states compete. Something like payroll tax, for example, which could be an effective national tax, is administered at state level, and each state gives different concessions and so on to attract business to their state, and that ends up with a very complicated system and sort of neuters the efficiency of that tax. Or you have multiple time zones, or you have, try and buy a car in one state and move it to another, this sort of thing, extradite criminals across the border.
That's one that's just incredible. You'd think, it'd be easy enough for police forces and legal courts in different states to be able to cooperate to extradite prisoners. I mean, we're one big country surrounded by water.
You'd have to go through this process. Different definitions of crimes and bail, different rules, which it's an unbelievable complication in a country that really struggles to present a national image and think in terms of national policy in areas that matter. I mean, not saying that you're getting rid of the states, but you define their role and you define the Commonwealth's role, and the other one gets out of of the activity.
And there's avoiding all that duplication. We'll go back to the Canada example of education. So in Canada, I imagine there still is a national curriculum. So there would be a body that looks after the curriculum and things like that, so that all Canadians are on the level playing field as far as what they're learning. But what you're suggesting is it's not administered by two different governments. There's just one government that administers it.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, the funding can then reflect that as well. Yeah. But the fact is that if you had some national standards body in education and in hospitals, for example, and schools, you don't really need the federal government department to do much more than that. And but they spend a lot of time. They've got very large bloated bureaucracies that spend their time monitoring what the states do. And not effectively tied to performance either. So, you know, what are you gaining by having all of that structure? And it's true in so many areas. And some of the big issues like the Barrier Reef, I mean, a national asset, but essentially administered by the state of Queensland, you know. Now, these are silly differences that don't make any sense.
Last night we did a whole 40 minutes talking about the Murray-Darling Basin. And again, it was the situation of these different organisations, different levels of government, just not working with each other. And in fact, quite the opposite, working against each other and almost competitive. And we're talking about the health of one of Australia's most important natural assets yet, and still can't get the cooperation together.
No, and that's a good example, I think, of how the federal structure just hasn't worked. And, you know, on a political level, we have a Senate, which was originally a state's house to look after the interests of states, a sort of a check, if you like, on the processes of government. But the Senate today has got very little to do with representing state interests. I mean, although the senators are drawn equally from states, they don't, you've got a pretty significant glad bag of people now that represent a whole lot of other things and a whole lot of other interests. And so that, you know, even that sort of level needs to be thought about as well.
Yeah, look, one of the things yesterday when we were talking about the Murray-Darling Basin, I had a bit of a joke with our guest that, it's taken Australia, took us so long to agree on rail gauges. How are we going to do with a serious issue like the Murray-Darling Basin? And he actually made the point, well, actually, I don't think we have quite got it together on rail gauges yet. There are still mismatches around the place.
No, we used to just, I remember as a kid going from Sydney to Melbourne, change trains at Albury. That's a good example of how extreme that process has been. And, you know, people forget that the Federation was negotiated during the 1890s. You had a significant recession in the 1890s. The issues and structures were different. And it was an interesting process. I mean, I think for a large part of the 1890s, New South Wales was not going to be part of Federation, but New Zealand was. And then it switched at the last minute. And these sort of things, you know, to some extent, there's historical accident there as to what structures we've ended up with. And I guess our founding fathers made it difficult to change the constitution by requiring a majority of the people in a majority of the states to support it. So we tend to always get a couple of states that don't support it. And so you don't get constitutional reform. The great bulk of referendum questions over the years have just, got an overwhelming no.
And possibly there were historic reasons for that, and maybe it was relevant, as you say, 100 years ago, but certainly the way things have changed, it's perhaps not that way anymore. Look, love to hear from you this morning. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Pav, and good morning, Dr. Hewson.
Good morning. Good
morning. Dr. Hewson, probably in your... covered this area for a while, you've probably come across a certain one of the Boyer lectures in 1979 by one Robert James Hawke. State mentality is hurting us all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a very good point to make. It's been an issue that's been kicked around in politics for a long time, but it's been very difficult to see much leadership on the issue. I must say, a few years ago when Tony Abbott became Prime Minister, one of the things that he promised to do was a proper reform of the Federation, review and reform of the Federation. And then, of course, once you've sort of allocated responsibilities correctly between the state and federal level, to have a reform of the tax system. But neither of those two things went very far, as did a lot of things under Abbott. So unfortunately, we've had a lot of those opportunities, if you like, over the years, going back to Hawke's Boyer lectures and many other examples where, you know, the issues have been raised and, the processes haven't gone very far
to,
at all.
To be fair, though, a very difficult thing to do.
It is, yes.
So, I mean, it really would take a politician with a lot of guts and a lot of foresight to do that. In fact, Nana Trucker says politicians are all about blowing their own trumpet and can only think of what will make them look good in their four-year term. I mean, if this sort of thing's going to happen, it really needs someone with a long-term vision, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's easy to get distracted by birthday cakes and lose the essence of what people are trying to do, might I make a point. You do need medium to longer term structural thinking. And our system doesn't support that. I mean, politics today has just become an incredibly short term focused game. You know, you score points on the other side, you shift blame to the other side, and you don't solve the problems. You just put, at best you patch them up and you move them down the road. And this is a big issue that really, you know, I think in the end these issues are too important now to be left to our short-term political process. We need to have some sort of federation reform commission that operates over, you know, independently of government, properly funded, marshals the best evidence, puts together the right sort of propositions and tries to move it forward. But as long as it's part of the day-to-day point scoring, I mean, I'm sure today if Morrison stood up and said, I want to do this, Shorten would disagree, and vice versa. Yeah. And that's why we don't make any progress. And people like Hawke, who tried over the years to do some of these things, you know, were knocked out by short-term politics.
It definitely needs a bipartisan approach, doesn't it, if we're going to do something like this. We would hope our politicians are big enough to be able to see that, and perhaps down the track.
You know, you see blame shifting as a significant element of the Commonwealth state problem. And, you know, I thought when Howard introduced the GST, for example, just to stay with that example, I thought it was insane to give the revenue, to commit the revenue to the states, because it meant an annual sort of shit fight to allocate the distribution of that money, because they're never going to agree. I mean, you never get enough. Whoever you are, and you feel some states always feel they pay too much and don't get enough back. And on the other side, you know, we've had the big debate, of course, that Western Australia's tax base has dwindled and they've fallen behind in the distribution, and that's become a very big political issue in Western Australia, seeing requiring the government, rather than being able to fix that problem, having to find additional money to sort of buy them off. That's a very inefficient way of addressing that issue, and of course the tax base is not as effective as people hoped it would be as well. So, I mean, these are pretty, they're there all the time, these issues. You see this you know, the blame game or the blame shifting between the Commonwealth and the states. Something goes wrong with schools, it's because the states didn't run them well, even though the Commonwealth may have been substantially responsible for funding them. You know, these issues are very real, and, you know, I think from the point of view of the Australian community, you're not getting the most efficient and effective value for money. The delivery of services is often compromised by just that simple blame-shifting game.
And, you know, it's a very expensive business. We're only a small country as far as population goes, but we're certainly represented by a lot of politicians and a lot of layers of government. I've got this text from Pete in Ballarat that says, while I understand Mr. Hewson's stance, the idea that we do away with state governments is misguided at best. The idea we could end up with a federal government with overarching power when states are far more progressive is completely unacceptable. The Victorian
I'm not talking about getting rid of states.
No,
I mean, I'm talking about allocating a responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, some services are better delivered at a state level than at the federal level. I mean, I think the example of schools and hospitals is a good one. They're essentially state. They're delivered by states. They're essentially state responsibilities. So why don't we just clean that up and close down the federal part of the education department, and, you know, the federal education department that really does little more than monitor all that. And, you know, they don't actually own and operate any schools. And I think there's probably only one federal hospital. I'm not sure how it tried one, and then that failed. But it's not about closing down states. It's about defining their role and consequently the role of the federal government. So you have a clear allocation of responsibilities and therefore, you know, a more cost-effective structure.
So really just, it's reducing the duplication. You're not wanting to abolish state government. I suppose it's the same with local government. There's also a role, and that needs to be there as well.
Well, local government have always been sort of the poor cousin, haven't they? They've never been properly identified and funded. And, of course, now we have a lot of pressure on local government rates trying to fund themselves because states and federally, at state and federal level, they're not funded. I mean, back in the Fraser government when I worked in the 70s, I think, it was more a federal responsibility, local government. And then, of course, I think in the Howard government tax package, including the GST and giving them the revenue, the responsibility for funding local government was to be picked up by the states. It wasn't, really. And so you've got this pressure. And then more recently, you've seen the local government try to get recognition in the Constitution in the hope that might lead to a secure funding base. And the two issues are not linked in that way. And you know, but they're the poor cousin, and so we haven't had, you know, at the local level, where you do have a lot of issues that can only be effectively dealt with at that level, they're not properly funded, they're not properly structured. So, you know, it is the three levels of government that need to be looked at. Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Good morning, Michael.
What I want to talk about is a couple of things, really. John, look, I've been following politics for about 50 years, and as you would be well aware, in your role, this has just been never-ending. Now, things do get done from time to time. Sometimes we hear about them, sometimes we don't. And we know from honest politicians that often there's a lot more work done behind the scenes at all levels than we hear about with the conflicts. But it is a very complex thing, and I think that the things you've identified and Pav are obviously just such sensible things. But it gets very complicated as well, not only with all the agendas and the motives, and often they're not even a matter of philosophical things. Often it's just say no for the sake of saying no, with people like Tony Abbott. And I would say Morrison's got more to worry about in his own party than he has from Bill Shorten at the moment. And I'm not sure, Pav, whether people are going to have a vision, because you can have them and then you're thrown out of your own party, let alone thrown out of office. So it is we just can't underestimate how difficult it is. And the other thing is that while I'd like to see a lot of things rationalised and unified and more efficient and not duplicated, I also know that what parts of Queensland law or Western Australian law or whatever, I'm calling from Victoria, or what other states' laws would I want to keep, or what other parts would I throw away. And so there's so many laws to work through. It's a very big job, and I'm just wondering how you see it being done and whether you're going to put your hand up in your busy role, because it's a monumental task. But if we ignore it, and just say it's too hard all the time, it will catch up with us, won't it? Mm-hmm. I think that my final comment is that one of the problems we've got at the moment is the government's too busy with other things to govern. And I don't say that sarcastically. We hear every day, and the river's a classic example. I remember John Anderson once said it was the poison chalice when he was handed that role when he was the Deputy Prime Minister. The amount of corruption in that area is beyond belief, really, isn't it? So there's a lot of agendas. Anyway,
we've got a few points up there that we'll take up with John. John, look, successive governments have looked at this issue and done nothing about it. To do it or to embrace it, they almost need to give up a little bit of their power. They're really unlikely to do that, aren't they?
They are. I mean, they obviously resist it, and they are protective of what they've got, and in many cases they want more. But having said that, I mean, I do think the only way to do it is to have some sort of federation commission, which is independent of government and can work, as you were saying before, in a medium to longer term sense. I mean, these are difficult issues. There's a lot of overlap. The more you think about it, the more you can find. And we don't even have sort of a checklist, if you like. That might be the place to start, a blank piece of paper to list down all these inefficiencies, inconsistencies, overlaps, duplications, and so on, and see how they might be reviewed. And there has been this sort of process. I mean, and there have been suggestions over the years that COAG, the Commission of Australian Governments, for example, could be a more formal structure. Yeah. Now, that was something that I think Hawke introduced. And in the early days, of course, it ran pretty well from that point of view. It tried to do some of these things that he'd outlined, I guess, in that Boyer lecture in 79. But, it's become more of a political bun fight than a constructive process. And these structures are there. They can be improved. But I do think in the end, you need to take it out of day-to-day politics, because people in politics today have become very self-absorbed, not only about themselves and their own party machinations, but of course, the bigger issues are more politically difficult. Mm. You don't have people prepared to stand up and argue a case day in, day out for some level of reform in a particular area. It's sort of, let's score a point today and move on tomorrow to another place, another issue. This short-termism is really a very significant constraint. But
almost playing into the news cycle.
Out of that is what I'm saying, yeah.
If you were putting a list together of the amount of duplication, the amount of different problems that people have bouncing between state and federal authorities, listen to this text. This is from Ray in Cooder. He said, how about a national registration for automobiles? Try being a transient seasonal worker who divides his time between Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria each year, legally required to change licence and rego three times a year. They just don't swap it over either. You have to cash in one rego and renew each time. Also, the cost of inspections and paperwork required. I mean, that just sounds like that in itself, the registration and lack of cooperation between the different states' road departments, is giving Ray from Cooder a hell of a headache there. And the amount of duplication from three different states there could be streamlined and simplified into one simple registration.
I've never understood why we have that. And as I mentioned before, you try buying a car in one state, try registering a car in a different state. Mm. You've got not only different registration structures and costs and paperwork and so on, but, you know, then you've got different insurance structures. And, you know, it just goes on. And the complication of somebody just trying to run a more nationally orientated or East Coast orientated business is staggering. It's the same as daylight saving. I mean, I know this has been a very controversial issue, but at times we've had a multiplicity of time zones down the East Coast.
Yep.
So in the same sort of longitude and different time zones, and that is quite disruptive going from Brisbane to Sydney, for example, just the 1 hour time difference.
But try being a radio presenter when you have to mention three different time calls. There was one point then there was five different time zones in Australia, and it just seemed ludicrous. While we were on the road stuff, because this is another point you've made, this text comes in from Jenny, who says, we could at least have national road rules. I think national vehicle registration would be wonderful, etc. But, I mean, it seems incredible that we can't all agree on things like speed limits and the most basic safety rules that seem to be either duplicated or different from state to state.
And see, the downside of a lot of that is, of course, when you've got differences in regulatory structures and frameworks and requirements and so on, it sort of it can be abused. I mean, people can try and take advantage of that, and I just find it incredible. I mean, the ones the extradition, the point I made before, I mean, somebody commits a crime in the Gold Coast, you know, and they have to be extradited to Tweed Heads or something, you know, and you say, can't you sort of walk across the border there? The borders have become ridiculously, ridiculous impediments. And I know that, you know, that's a big question because that's a different legal system. And there's a lot of vested interests in keeping the systems the way they are. Whereas I think, again, you've got to take it out of those vested interests and identify the vested interests and say, okay, they've got to be put aside. We've got to get a national view of car registration, legal systems and so on, because I find it quite staggering, some of that. It's so disruptive and very, in the end, bottom line, quite expensive and quite inefficient from the point of view of running a good government.
We know how much it costs, the legal costs are, and there you go, the lawyers are obviously enjoying a little bit of duplication there, I would imagine.
Well, don't they always win? I think in the end, we say lawyers are the only winners in a lot of these issues. And yeah, when you've got major infrastructure projects that require the cooperation of the Commonwealth and the states, and you don't get it, you get people playing games about, we won't support that particular infrastructure project. We'd rather, you know, there's not even a national sense of what are the most important. You know, let's rank these projects and where they go cross borders. You know, mention the Murray-Darling, but look at a lot of the road projects and. And, you know, if you took a national view of where we really need major airports or major ports or major, you know, there's still a, even within some states, for example, for a long time in New South Wales, I don't think there was any particular port strategy, let alone having a national view as to how that should be done. And so we have competition, and that can be quite disruptive to business and to life as well.
Let's have a chat to Bruce. G'day, Bruce.
Yeah, g'day, Pav. G'day, John. Yeah, I think you've pretty well covered my beef. I work for a New South Wales-based company, but I just happen to live in Wodonga in Victoria, and I went in this week to change the garaging of a New South Wales registered vehicle to my home address in Victoria, and they couldn't do it. So how do we get around that? You know, the New South Wales-based company doesn't have an address in Victoria, so they can't register the vehicle in Victoria. And I live in Victoria, and I'm not shipping back to New South Wales just so I can put it on the reg. It's just ridiculous.
I shouldn't laugh, but it is ridiculous, Bruce. There's no other word for it.
That's always a point of rub, really. I think that those sort of road rules and car registration, truck registration, that sort of thing, there is no sense to that. And when you get that reflected in different you know, structures and penalties, different insurance charges, different, you know, you've got layers of complexity that are totally disruptive to the lives of just average people. People trying to run a small business or, as you say, live on one side of the border and often work on the other. I mean, in Albury, Wodonga being essentially one town, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Although nobody, you know, there's a lot of jealousy within that as well. Yeah, a lot of
But I imagine it's a big frustration. A lot of people in the Albury-Wodonga twin cities.
Like you say, with the road rules, like in New South Wales, you're not allowed to do a U-turn at traffic lights unless the sign says you can. In Victoria, you are allowed to do a U-turn at traffic lights unless the sign says you can't.
Yeah, you got to wonder. It must be a bit confusing for people who live in towns like Albury-Wodonga.
Oh, it's just a nightmare.
You got to remember which side of the river you're on. That's how you got to drive.
Exactly. That's
ridiculous. Hey, thanks, Bruce, for your call.
Thanks very much, Sam.
Hey, listen, I got a text here that says, Australia has more senators than the USA. Please ask him why we're so over-governed. Is that true? That couldn't be right, is it?
I'm not sure of the numbers, but I think most people find it odd that you have the same number of senators from each state, given the very significant differences in the size of states. I think we have basically 12 senators, don't we, from each state. And so Tasmania gets as many senators as New South Wales.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that gives you a disproportionate weight of smaller states, which I guess in a way was the idea was, okay, let's make it a state's house. Let's have equal representation of the states to put a layer of state, influence and thinking over the political process. But having said that, the Senate today is not a state's house. I mean, I remember Keating, he said a lot of things in my time, but he did say that he thought the Senate was unrepresentative swill, which is meaning, I think, essentially that you know, they are not representative of what they were structured or what they were, what was the original concept. And, you know, and so you have a disproportionate weight in the Senate where you have to find 12 senators from Tasmania, for example, And this is a significant constraint itself on government. And if they were to vote in blocks, I guess it makes a bit of a difference, doesn't it? But they don't.
And in fact,
senators today represent a whole lot of different interests, and some of them have got their own very low representation.
That's right. So in many ways, they are the unrepresentative swill that Paul Keating was referring to, because a senator nowadays, if they get the right preferences, can get up and into the Senate on very few votes. And as you say, I don't think the system was designed to be like that. So that's probably something they need to obviously
see. There's layers of rules there. And, you know, some states have upper houses, some don't as well at their own political structure. So, I mean, these issues are very significant. There is a natural tendency to say, oh, it's all too hard, or more important issues to deal with today. And that's true. There are a lot of issues that really do need a more immediate and substantive response. But having said that, getting that basic structure right over a period of years, maybe decades, makes a lot of sense. But you won't do it in the day-to-day political process that we've got, where you just spend your time scoring points and shifting blame and not dealing with issues.
It's almost a bigger issue for us than if we become a republic or not, isn't it? It's such a serious thing. And to get it right, it does need to take a bit of thinking, foresight, and you've got to plan ahead a long way, I think.
Nobody's got the full wisdom as to exactly what to do and how to do it, but it's not a reason for not making an attempt to do it, in my view. And it's time we did have that level of leadership. And look, I'm always staggered that some of the big issues that, I think the average voter would feel that there should be bipartisan support, bipartisan agreement, we don't get it. Other political systems which are quite adversarial, like the Danish system, for example, they'll pull these big issues out, put up some sort of commission or committee structure to deal with them and just get on and get them done. And we see that in, you know, the issues like climate change, for example. The point scoring between Commonwealth and the states on an issue that is of national significance is just staggering. And, most people would say, well, just get on with it, just put them together in some sort of, put force the bipartisanship in one form or another, because if you leave it to the adversarial system we've got, which, as I've said, is very short-term and mostly negative, mostly today somebody proposes something, the other side just says, they might say, we'll have a look at it, but they basically intend to oppose it because they don't want to give them, any sort of leg up in terms of the eyes of people. Now, I think that's become counterproductive, where you look at the response of the electorate over the years. Now the standing of both major parties is on the nose. I mean, both major parties used to get about 95% of the votes. They get about 70% of the votes now. The numbers declining as people have lost confidence in the major parties. They're looking for independents and minor parties to either to make a protest or perhaps hopefully to improve the structure of government.
And as you suggest, it leads to this sort of policy paralysis that we get with nothing ever getting done.
That's right.
Peter wants to have a chat. Good morning, Peter.
Yeah, look, I can understand, John, you're often on the numbers. You probably should stand as an independent, and you probably get into if you want to do. But anyway, going from there...
Have you met my wife?
No, I haven't.
You'd have a view about that.
Yeah, but you know, there is big issues to do with the viability of certain areas such as Tasmania and Northern Territory. And, you know, somebody said just recently, and I don't know how right they was, they reckoned that Tasmania could have, billions and billions of dollars worth of debt, you know, in the next 10 years or something like that. And they, you know, it's... You know, Northern Territory seems almost unviable, and so does Tasmania. So, you know, it would be a real problem if New South Wales had too much power. And this is a bit of a concern that, you know, we do need to protect these less populated places. Otherwise, they just about bloody die.
Yeah, look, a good point you're making there, John. Do the states sort of, in some way, keep the federal system in check?
Well, that has always been the structure. I mean, you're putting it, remember that if you look at the history going into the 1890s, you know, and the origin of each of the states, I mean, they're very different. And in many cases, they were trying to be protective of what they had. But, you know, I remember in the Fraser government, we used to have these premiers' conferences, and you know, Malcolm would get support for particular issues by doing a bit of a deal with Tasmania. And somebody once said to him, you know, exactly how many bridges can we put across Bass Strait, Malcolm? They poured a lot of money, disproportionate money. Now, I'm not saying I agree with the comment that you do need to have a structure that properly funds the lesser states that don't have the industrial base, that don't have the population and so on that allow them to be sort of standalone operations. But having said that, it can be abused at times too, and that's again an issue that needs to be addressed, as to, you know, there is a collective national responsibility in ensuring that they are properly funded. But, you know, look at the Northern Territory. I know it's not a state, but here we have a territory that's almost bankrupt and, you know, badly managed over years. And in those circumstances now, there's a big issue as to just how much should the Commonwealth pick up here, and how much, you know, should the other states have to fund that and to bail it out in some form or another? That's a difficult issue. But it is an element that has just been highlighted by your caller, that this part of our federation needs to be addressed as part of this process.
Jean wants to have a chat with us. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning. I'm 86 years old. And I have been thinking about these issues for years and years. So it's music to my ears to hear that the ABC, John Hewson, in bringing them to date. I've got nothing more to say. Only God bless somebody who will get this commission started. Very, very good luck. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. That was nice words there. There are people who think like you, John, out there.
That's good. Well, you know, I think some of these issues, people look for a bit of leadership. They want, you know, nobody has is not the repository of all wisdom here on this issue. It's going to be something that's going to have to be thought about and analysed and developed over a period of time. But a short-term political structure doesn't give you the capacity to do that. I mean, as I said, Abbott sort of set up a structure to do this, and he put it in one department, Prime Minister and Cabinet. Then they kept narrowing and narrowing and narrowing the brief. To in the end, they didn't do very much at all. And, you know, what, that was pointless. You can't have it done within government. It's got to be done outside of government by people that, you know, drawing on world expertise.
I've actually got a text here. I've got a text here from Roy. It says, why don't Howard, Keating, etc., as wiser older heads, get together and do something about federation? I mean, is there a place here for older politicians with the experience and a bit of profile to actually step into this space and start doing a bit of bipartisan approach?
It's an interesting thought. I mean, you know, you tend to have these proposals around all the time that, you know, you should draw on that sort of expertise. And to some extent, it would be relevant. They've had the hardline experience of operating in that structure. And their own personal experiences, but it's very difficult to get them either re-engaged or, you know, to work constructively. And I do think, though, that you would, as a part of this process, draw on the experience of a lot of people that that have operated in the system, seen its weaknesses, and at their time didn't do much about it.
Makes a lot of sense, John, and really appreciate you joining us this morning on the radio to talk about it. And good luck with the quest, all right?
Okay, mate. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
John Hewson there, Professor at Crawford School of Public Policy at ANU, and also, of course, he's the former Liberal Opposition Leader on ABC Radio.